Hello and welcome to another episode of In the Margins. My name is Eli and here with me today is John. John is an English and philosophy student at Wilfrid Laurier University who also operates a poetry Instagram at John Arthur Wood. He writes short fiction in his free time and wants to publish books, but nobody knows if he ever will. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you today?
I'm good. We had a nice little chat about writing, about Radio Laurier and podcasting. And so I think we're ready to jump right in.
Awesome.
So you're a writer, you are in fiction, in poetry. So what got you into writing?
Well, I think a lot of writers have the same kind of origin story, is that, you know, we did it when we were younger, and we we fell in love with it at a young age or something like that. I can't really remember like the first thing I intended to write. I just remember I once wrote a story when I was a little kid about a banana knight. He was a banana, but he also like did the swashbuckling.
I love that.
Then I thought I was writing a book when I was like 12, because I wrote a page and then that was a chapter in my head. I wrote one and that was a chapter is about a hitman, and he, you know, I wrote 10 pages, so I thought I had 10 chapters. And yeah, that was probably the first time I was, you know, feeling chuffed to myself. I was having a good time writing.
You were getting ahead of everything at a young age.
Pretty much just kind of maintained consistency. I think I took it a little bit more like seriously when I was 16. I was like, you know, starting to write, even, you know, journal and stuff and think about stories and characters and things. And yeah, probably about 16, I was like, yeah, like it's, you know, I gotta put time into this.
What happened to Banana Man?
So there was a war, obviously. It's a very serious conflict. The geopolitics were off the dome. And, you know, my man, Banana, I think he like just fought other bananas. He maybe was like a merc. Let's assume he was a mercenary. He was on his quest. There might have been a princess. There might not have been. I don't remember. I think at that point, I
guess if she was a princess, she would be appealing.
Oh, man. I slipped right into that one, didn't I? Oh,
you sure did.
Wow.
I guess the funds are going to be split between us, huh?
Oh my god. I'm so bad at puns, actually, but that was excellent.
I love puns so much. I will probably hurt you throughout this show because I love puns.
Oh, no, that was good. That was good. Yeah, Banana Man, I don't know, lost in the annals, Banana Man, to history and time.
Oh, poor Banana Man.
I know, I'll probably come back to it when I'm bored.
Hopefully. I would love to see that as a children's story. I think that would be a great topic.
I would love to see. I mean, like, I think about writing about animals all the time, like animals as creatures. I think writing about food as creatures would be, like, food as characters would be super, super enticing.
That'd be interesting.
Like, Sausage Party exists, and I don't even want to step near that for all that. It just makes me uncomfortable even thinking about it.
Sentient sausages
are probably the sorriest excuse I've ever seen. God.
I feel like that would be even worse as a movie. Talking sausages.
So I suppose I don't want to spoil Sausage Party for any of the listeners, but it sort of just boils down to the ending, which is probably the most, like, so it's an
intro. You sound so distressed right now.
It's okay. So the whole movie is about this weird god complex of food trying to escape this existential dread of being in a supermarket, I guess. Fair enough, Franco. And the ending, for some reason, I don't know. Apparently there's this huge metaphor where they, like, kill God. And then there's this massive intimate scene involving literally every character who has a line. And the animation portrays them in intimate acts, just acting like
food. Oh,
it's
that's
it's terrifying. And I honestly, you know what? And I'm sorry we're here. Is there any question that you'd like to ask me to this horrifying topic?
How can I get published? Or I guess I can get published. Or if something like that can get published, I'm sure that I will make my way through the industry at some point.
Yeah, I think the standard bar is has
reached in the basement
in a trench levels of depth in how low it is. Such that I don't know if there is a bar anymore. I think all art is just being equivocated to itself.
It's kind of like that time I went to a museum, or was it, this might have been a meme that I saw. Either I went to a museum and saw it, or I saw it in a meme. I can't remember which. But it's like when I saw this thing, and it's just like a piece of cheese with hair on it, and it was being called art, and I was like, you know what? Abstract art is one thing. I can respect abstract art, but when you just have a piece of cheese with hair on it, I'm like, no, that's not. You can't.
No, yeah,
it doesn't count.
That is actually a really, that's a huge thing I've been thinking about recently. Is the like I always like have these thoughts of like the State of the Union, but it's like in regards to like writing or literature and stuff. Like, you know, all the freshest, like what is passing off as art right now, right? And
mm-hmm.
What are the big things that are coming out that people are doing in a particular form right now? The form that I'm, I guess, observing in that way is poetry. Not the poetry books per se are not being released. They are, but a lot of poets, or at least poets that then release books oftentimes themselves, begin on Instagram and are posting in social media and
that's interesting.
Things like that. And you kind of do, you see on Instagram that there are like three or four different groups of people on the internet who like are poets. You have the people who picked this up yesterday and are going through something, whatever that is, inadvertently, like unfortunately, it's a breakup. and this is like the sort of the borderline here where I don't know what to like, and I feel bad about even saying it, but like it's just not poetry, you know? Like, because the poetry is, it's not a poem, it's a sentence. And it's not even a grammatical sentence. It's not even syntactically correct. However, the sentence is such like, you know, I loved the way you smelt, but you obviously smelt another. And that's the bit. And it'll all be lowercase. It'll all be over a white background or with a minimalist drawing next to it.
And or a really sad woman in black and white crying.
Yeah, classic. Another huge classic one. So that's one group, right? Like they're just going through something, and they need a place to vent. There are the people who have been doing this for like at least a couple of years, or maybe a year and a half, or just have kind of gotten like this moderate following, and they've got a book out and things like that. You know, like they're going with it. They're going the game. And then there are the group that I think I belong to, which is like the literal million and a half people who are not getting very, very much follow. Not that I care, but you know,
it's nice to have a following.
And they are just like, and I find people like this all the time. Like, not that I do anything with them. I sound like I'm gathering them like the Umbrella Academy.
Together we make a team of poets.
So many incredible pieces. Like, you know, I was reading this poem. There's this account, like Gothic Green or something, and they're like 16 and they have these incredible pieces that just blow me away. There's like someone else, there's like a poet laureate who's just like on Instagram, just like doing stuff. And I'm like, in my head, I'm thinking, you got to save this stuff and put it in a book because this is actually like good stuff. You know what I mean? Like this is stuff that people will buy. I don't want to buy a book full of, you know, I loved the way you smelt, but then you smelt another. Like, that's, you know, that's just not what
I kind of want that on just, a wall, like, live, laugh, love.
It just makes me, like, ask the limit, right? The limit of a form, which is, in a part, it's interesting to me. Part of it, it's a little frustrating, but I kind of get over that. But most definitely, And there we go. That's how we've bridged sausage party to critical thinking.
Poetry.
Critical thinking in literature and writing. Excellent. Excellent.
You are definitely a philosophy major. That's what I have to say. Okay. It's funny. It's fun. It's nice. I usually have to prompt guests a lot, so it's nice to just see where you're going with things. It's really nice.
I guess a term is over, so my brain is like running on a circular treadmill with nowhere to go. So
it's like a little rodent in like one of those spinning wheels, but there's nowhere for the rodent to go after.
Absolutely that. I need something to analyze. Sure, all my friends can tell you that
I will
die trying to analyze the most unnecessary thing, you know, and I'm, you know, not even to sound charming, I'm certain it's annoying, like 1:30 in the morning, and I'm like, guys, you know, sleeping is the most relevant to, you know, my friends are playing like League of Legends or something, like they don't give a damn about
it. They don't care, they're like, shut up.
Like, you know, like I remember Vic one time, really, like I was going off, I was probably like 5 minutes plus just going, and you know, they just came in and were like, is this going somewhere? And I was like, oh no, it isn't.
Stabbed in the heart.
I just had to back up. I was like, you know, really, no, it's this. Thank you for telling me. I was probably going in circles.
I relate though, because I do something. And so I'm a pain in the ass to watch movies with, because every time I'll be like, oh, this is where it's going to go. These are the different tropes and different directions it could take. And usually I am right. And it annoys the crap out of my family.
Oh my God. I was, I do that. And it's like, I'm not like, I find that I doesn't even matter what I'm watching, you know, like I did that over an episode of Schitt's Creek.
Oh, wow. There's a lot of stuff you could do in there.
Oh yeah. No, it's very, yeah. You know, and you know what? I haven't finished it, so I can't make up my full mind on it, but I have things to say about Schitt's Creek, as though anybody wants to hear it.
Go ahead.
Well, it was this episode. It was like an Even Stevens situation. So like, you know, a character lost a thing and they were, you know, being silly, being like, oh, my life is different forever. It'll change forever now. And by the end of the episode, obviously spring backed to where they were and I saw it coming. And so I announced it. And, my partner at the time, my partner, Nick, stared at me and was like, why do you have to do that? Like, it was, you know, there was no punchline. Obviously we weren't watching with a bunch of people, so like, you know, there was no no one was gonna like chide me and go, hey, that was a good call, you know, you're really smart. I just kind of
just your partner who's tired of your bullshit.
Yeah, like shut the hell up and watch the show, like just watch it, it's gonna happen, who cares if you know what's gonna happen next, you'll see it, I guess. So I think I think as I get older, I'm trying to vocally censor my shelf. It talks, I guess. My shelf.
Wow, you should censor your shelf. It has some strong opinions about things.
I know.
So many opinions.
Oh, so terrible. So sorry for the tangent. My apologies.
No worries. Do you think that's partially kind of why you like poetry, so that you can kind of get that internal voice out onto paper?
Absolutely. I have a very strong aversion to taking, now this is going to sound really bad, but I have a very strong aversion to taking poetry too seriously in a very particular context.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean with writing. I already know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, I feel like it's just kind of something, you know, I think the days of the Bandini of the Bandini, what am I talking about?
I don't know. What are you talking about?
Days of the Beanie King, who sits in this like half crouch with his knees up and he's like touching his face. He smokes even though he's self-aware of its consequences. I think the day of that person is done. We need to get over this faux deep, unintellectual, like multidiscipline neo-Greek myth of this stoic man who gets to know and say everything ever and have everything be deep. I'm so done with people who, regardless of their life experiences, talk at volume, like, you know, you can't just, it's just not that deep sometimes, I think. And there's a really, really, really large struggle with taking yourself so seriously. I was watching a live, and the live was about an Instagram live, a poetry Instagram live from this account that I follow. And they had a guest on, and this guest was talking about writing, and they were just speaking utter tosh, like absolute utter tosh. I had to, when people just say something and you're just in your head, you're like, oh my God, like, woof, get out, like, stop talking. Because like they were describing the process of writing like they were taking a strip off their arm. Like this is it, you know, if they write this, then their heart and soul will align to the stars and spectral energy will fulfill them. And I'm like, what? Like, what is happening? No. They were like, sometimes when I write, I need to seclude myself into a dark room to just, you know, absorb myself in the space. And I thought to myself, that is utter nonsense. That's nonsense. I write on my couch. At any point in the day, I write on my couch. I write on my bed. I write on my desk. I have the lights on.
Sacrilege.
I like to wear comfortable clothes, you know, I like to be in a good mood, and I write. And it's not, you know, like, it's just not that big a deal, you know? I could be writing good stuff, I could be writing bad stuff. I could, most of the time, I'm probably writing pretty meh stuff. But it doesn't matter, you know? I'm just a guy, and I just write the words. I just put the words on the page. You know, we just kind of got to get over it.
Yeah, I think I get what you mean, because it's something similar with, so I do a lot of audio dramas or long form type writing. And I find a lot of people, myself included sometimes, just take it so seriously and overthink it when really it doesn't have to be something profound all the time or this greatest masterpiece of all time. If you, silly things are just as good as very deep, tragic things, you know? And it's, and a lot of the times you can psych yourself out if you're always focusing on drinking it in. Because for some people that works, and it's great if it works for you. But I think a lot of people, you're right, overthink it and make it into this big thing, when really it's just more about, for a lot of people, having fun and enjoying what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You're absolutely correct, in my opinion. You're absolutely correct.
In your very biased opinion.
My very, very biased and heavy-handed opinion, yes, I think you're absolutely correct. For example, I tried it a couple times, and I guess, you know, like the process, right? Like the process, yeah, like, you know, I think people can do different things. You know, people can employ different strategies. One thing too, on like the idea of like writing and then like the perception of the writer and like, you know, that whole dichotomy. I will be the first one, not the first one, but I'll be one of the people to say, I am nothing like the things that I write. You know, I think I like the most the fact that even if you think you know me because you read my work, you don't. If you believe that you have seen deep into the things, even the things that I write that are like very personal, right? That can obviously stem from either a generalized or a specific personal experience. All of that is explicitly fictional to a degree, right? I've never written a poem about a specific event or a specific memory or things like that. And that's very specific for me because I don't like that. That's not the job of the writer, in a strict like, because I would consider myself a writer before I consider myself like a poet, and as a writer, that's your job is not to be there. Your job is to be so not there that the person reading your stuff can be there for you, and so I would almost be like weirded out if someone messaged me out of nowhere and was like, oh my God, I totally relate to you, and I'm like, maybe, I guess. You know, it might be something like this. Like, we probably have to have a conversation first, you know, so you could talk to me without doing that. And in fiction, that's like the main goal. And poetry, I like to do that as well. And I completely forgot what I was trying to say before I got so I'm so sorry.
That's okay. I think the point you're trying to get to is maybe that a lot of people think that. No, actually, I don't know what point you were trying to get to. I was trying to think of a point.
I'm so sorry.
It was entertaining. It was entertaining. Okay. It's all good.
Well, then that's what matters, I guess.
That's what matters. But yeah, it's definitely something, and I think for some people, taking it seriously is what works for them. But I think, yeah, you're right that a lot of people, they take it too seriously and they get too into their own heads, and you feel like you know this person. You went on a different tangent that is also interesting. I think a lot of parasocial relationships end up being confusing because people feel like they know this person, but really you only know a part of this person that they choose to show you, and also they don't know anything about you. And I think that's where, with social media, the line is kind of getting blurred, especially for big accounts like writers or creators in general.
Absolutely. I think there's almost like a bit of, it's a strange social place to be in, to reveal a certain amount of yourself to the person and then have the notion of you as a person be sort of transcribed or based by your work, which I think that's what I was trying to get at. Just the idea of like, if someone were to be exclusively defined as a person by their work, that's not like necessarily a problem, but like, you know, it would really suck if somebody was unable to see more to you than as a person than that. Like if someone, which is often what happens when someone explodes as a writer, like George Martin will never not be able to be identified by A Song of Ice and Fire, and Tolkien will never not be synonymous with his books that he's written and the world that he created, which I think is very powerful. But I also find it's almost personally diminishing, because Tolkien was an environmentalist, really liked nature and trees and the English countryside. And he had a great fondness for that. And like, had a lot of ideas about morality and the idea of gentrification was really huge. Because a lot of people, you know, and nobody likes to admit it, like I know about it, but I'm going to expose myself here. I haven't read the Lord of the Rings books, but I'm very familiar with his work. And so what a lot of people don't know, because they've watched the films and not read the books, is that in the books, the Shire is scoured. There's the scouring of the Shire, in which all of the hobbits return home and find that Saruman has pillaged the Shire and converted it into like this, that more like machination, gears, machines, sort of urbanization in a way. And they have a big fight, brouhaha, clish, clang, boom with the swords. But the Hobbit is, the Shire is never recovered. It's never brought back to that state we see it in the original, in the first inception of the story. So I find that's incredibly powerful, and tells a magically different story, and speaks to a little bit more of Tolkien's beliefs on gentrification and environmentalism and the idea of evil. But obviously, you know, it's hard to just go and isolate the writer from the work, especially if it explodes. So maybe I'm hoping my work never explodes. Interesting.
Interesting concept. Yeah, I see that a lot in, like, let's take YouTubers, for example. A lot of their content, they're placed so heavily on a pedestal, and they can't be divorced from their content. If they go out anywhere, people are going to know exactly who they are, and a lot of their work, they won't be able to move past what they're known for. Like, or kind of like big actors, like once you see them, like let's take this cast of Supernatural, for example. I think it ended. I don't know much about Supernatural, but I know that those actors, now that they've done that, whenever they're in another movie, it'll take people out of the movie because they'll be like, oh, hey, those are the Supernatural guys, I think is what you're trying to get at, right?
Yeah. There's a really, really good story about the comedian Eric Andre, who was in Vancouver one day, and he's eating like a sandwich. He's like in a, on a patio of, a, you know, he's eating lunch, right? And Eric Andre truly is a normal character, but if you're familiar with his comedy, he can be very, very, you know, absurd. And so this guy, this random person on the street, sees Eric Andre and starts like jumping and like slamming him on the back and like being all weird. And Eric Andre is like, man, I'm just trying to eat lunch. Like, I don't want this. Like, this is not what I'm here for. And I think it's super, oh my God, no, I know exactly how it is. Because I was talking about how the relationship between the things I write and then the, you know, the idea of image and interpersonality, man, it all loops. So it's just so palpable the way that, and I love the YouTube is such an interesting platform for artist to art, right? Because it essentially relies on the personal relationship you develop with the individual. Not that necessarily their content can be separate, but you're there because of the person who's there. You've developed this, and I love that parasocial relationship with the person on the screen. And so now all of the things that they do, you are synonymous with them as a person.
And it's personal.
And it is personal. There's no doubt about it. There, you know, certain YouTubers have come and gone in which the majority of their content, they do portray a character. A lot of those people have kind of gone now because people want or have found that they want that personal connection, even if it is a farce, right? Like, even if it's not, if it's fallacious, they don't care because they want that sense of, this is a real person, I'm watching real things. They crave that sense of like authenticity in the things they consume that fictional media per se can't really achieve.
I wonder if that's connected to the fact that we've been using social media more and more instead of connecting with the people around us. So then people are craving closeness, so they turn to social media, to their so-called friend group, which they may or may not have in real life. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of perpetuates it, and everyone feels like they're stuck online and there's nothing they can do about it.
Yep. The interior digital space, and how it takes up genuinely more intellectual capacity than at times physical social interaction. Not to completely just sail the ship out to sea, but kind of coming around to the idea of like, the internet in the way it was implemented, I feel like is really bad. like Pandora's box kind of thing. I think this is not that obviously to such a stringent degree, but kind of, because with the internet, we have the capacity to develop secret means of doing terrible acts and being horrible, and it just literally allows us to be worse people and good people, right? But the good acts, I think, that we partake in the internet oftentimes are completely
overrun
for the real world. But the less honorable, the less moral deeds are obviously more objectionable, and you know, you can't always, you know, interact with that in a physical space. But that's my rant on the internet. And if you have any more questions about writing, I would like to talk about writing. I'm so sorry.
That's A-okay. Yeah, that was just a really interesting talk, because I agree with you on some points, because I think that you're right, that I think that the internet is a great tool, but we've become too reliant on it, too dependent on it. But moving away from that to the actual topics at hand that we were supposed to cover, but we did cover a good amount of writing. And I guess we can skip over the Instagram questions because we covered a good amount of internet. So you write poetry. Do you prefer it over writing in general, or I guess narrative writing?
I think, well, okay. And so I don't think on paper, I don't think I like writing poetry more. But poetry for me, I think, fulfills a very specific kind of need. Because poetry for me is like little capsule ideas of things that are really cool or thoughts. It's kind of like journaling. And like a lot of writers use journals to like save ideas or to brainstorm. And sometimes it's just silly, right? It's like literary flexing to a degree or training. And sometimes I think it's really fun to see how small a piece can be while still containing a narrative. Like there was this one, like I wrote a small piece. It's like micro, and it was about a guy who was divorced and is at a cafe, and someone is like, basically there's a waitress talking to him, and he sort of is going through this like internal dialogue with how he lost his marriage. And it's, I don't know, I thought it was really fun. So I wrote it and I put it out, but I think, poetry just has a place for me. And that's like that quick sort of, not like expendable, because I still think a poetry that I write can be thoughtful, but, I think I would want to hang my hat more on, traditional narrative writing, because it just allows me more room. And I used to be really scared of like not being able to write a lot, and that I'm not really scared of that anymore. I can get pages down and stuff like that, like if I really want to, over some time.
So poetry is just kind of like a catharsis space for you, and a space for you to practice and experiment.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is kind of, you know, I'm not trying to demean the process, because I still like poetry and I still think it's like a good skill for me to have, and I like doing it, obviously. But writing is just, it's just where I want to be. It just gives me so much. I can tell whole stories, right? And
yeah.
I can give you exactly what I want, and I can play with what you expect and do all that, right? And poetry is either, you know, exactly what's going on and it's just fun, you're just reading the words, or it's so interpretable that at first glance you almost can't even grasp it, because, you know, you're like, oh, well, what the hell does this mean? Like, I don't even, like, obviously they're talking about something, but what are they talking about? Because I have no clue. And so, yeah, especially for the space as well, because I'm writing poetry that I know is going to be put on Instagram. So, like, I know that this is going to be read, like, maybe once, maybe twice, you know, it's going to be given a like, and it'll be, you know, it'll be moved on. So it makes me think about the way I play with depth. You know, do I want to write a piece that's got some nice little seeds, and if you read it a couple times, you might be able to pick up what I'm trying to put down, which is what a lot of like old modernists would do, because who wants it to be easy, I guess. Do I write a poem about a ham sandwich that, you know, is about a ham sandwich, because I mentioned the fact that it's a ham sandwich and I describe it as a sandwich. Because I was hungry and I thought, why don't I write a poem about a ham sandwich? Because that would be really fun. And that just comes back to the whole thing of like, the silly things can be incredibly fun. And I find the sillier I get, the more fun that I have. But yeah, probably for me, writing like long form narrative, I wanted to make the thing I'm writing now to be a short story, and now it's become a novella. And I don't know if it will, like, you know, I know I've got two that I need to write. Like, it's not all going to be in one, but it's kind of just getting large now. And like, I don't know, I'm like already thinking about where I want to go back and add more stuff. And it's just going to get bigger and bigger, Eli. It's just going to get bigger. What am I
gonna do? Your editor's going to be like, oh my God.
No, like,
cut this down.
Nah, it's so strange. But yeah.
So tell me about your story. Like, what's the concept? What are the genres? What's the storyline like? If you're okay with sharing any of those.
That's completely fine. I'd love to share it. That's actually, you know what? I sucker punch my friends every single time I get on call with them, because I tell them about what's going on in my story. And I was
thinking
of like the backs, like, you know, the back of the book, the back of the book. On a strange and mysterious desert world, two women are separated by crisis and murder and death. It follows two women after this on this strange desert world. Their home is destroyed, and both cast off into varying different adventures in this strange and mysterious desert world. And so essentially the whole inception of the story was that I was writing sort of like serials, but not serials, of this character doing things when I was like sort of training and stuff. And, you know, there was it was like a space explorer. He went all these planets. And then I was talking about a particular planet that was cool. And all I wanted to do was smash all of my favorite things or favorite settings together. Right. I just wanted to take all the toys that I love and go wham and make a new thing. And that's what this is. So there's elements of Dune. Not that I've read it, but I have a great fascination for it because Dune is weird. So there's Dune. There's elements of the anime and manga series Trigun. There's elements of Mad Max, kind of in like setting and stuff. There's elements of like kind of Star Wars. There's elements of Lovecraft, kind of, not the weird subtle racist stuff, which is a huge like just in the realm of, you know, human acts and stuff. And like, you know, because essentially, you know, and I'll pull the curtain back a little bit. What I'm doing is the story basically goes half on a weird human culty kind of like depth of depravity tale, and then the other goes on a space sci-fi western tale. And I have looped now. I've got those two plot lines. They're going pretty strong, and they're going to loop. They're going to come back together. They have to at some point, because you can't make two books that are that are in the same book. You just can't do that. I for one am stunned that George R. R. Martin is so, you know, applauded and things, when essentially he's written two stories at once. He's written the Daenerys story, which takes place literally a continent away from every other character, essentially. And somehow that's like not its own book. It's nuts. It's nuts. And so there are a couple POVs and I mess around with that. And I'm having a lot of fun. Honestly, the end of the day, I'm having so much fun writing this story that I don't care if anybody reads it, because when it's done, I'm just going to sit back and go, hot damn, that's some good. That's so much fun. You know, people wear long coats and it's awesome. And they got glasses and they, you know, there's cool characters and they say funny lines, and I'm just having the most fun ever. I think that's just the main point. And I see a lot of people like online preach this, is that if you're not writing something, or you have all these expectations about the story you're writing, and you want it to be your magnum opus or something, like you want it to be huge and deep and profound, I don't know. I feel like that book is never going to get written. That book will never be written. But the book that will be written, or the story even, is the story you like, with all these silly things in it that you love, that you can't stand but love. And you put them all in there, and it just makes this beautiful, beautiful pie of, oh my God, this book is excellent. You know, like that's the stuff. These are the things that dreams are made of, I guess.
Yeah, I think for some people, yeah, it's definitely, because I remember my first two stories, actually, that I started writing original fiction, that I put way too much into it. I enjoyed it, but I was way overthinking themes and ideas, and I just shoved it all into one book, and it all just kind of, it's kind of like when you're baking a cake, you can't throw in Oreos and pretzels and extra sugar and, hey, maybe let's add five more eggs. You can't, it's too much. It won't balance itself out. Right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So,
and then if you're taking yourself seriously, you're like so frustrated. You're like, why isn't this working? But you just need to slow down, maybe take a look at a few recipe books, and split it up into a couple of different cakes if you need to, you know. But no, absolutely. That's a really interesting concept. Like, just haven't, like, it's just really fun. It reminds me of this one book called The Fifth Season. It's one of my favorites. It has three different points of view in it, and it's first person, second person, third person. And it all ties together. Yeah. I've never seen second person used in a book. And I've never seen a book that ties those three things together so well. Like, highly, highly recommend. A lot of people hate it because of that, but I like it.
Well, that sounds super, super awesome. Wow. Well, okay. The one thing that I don't know where you stand on the classics. I feel like a lot of people, when they get into writing and they like learn about literature and stuff, they go either way. You know, I haven't met many fence sitters when it comes to like the old modern classics. But Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway is it's an old book, but in regards how the experiment of it, the book has very little plot. It's almost entirely prose, and it's about like four characters, and like five characters. There's like six POVs. There's six POVs. There's so much interior monologue, but it's all so well written. Like it is so well written. I don't know. You just got to read it. It's not very long as well, which is awesome. So I would totally recommend that as our recommendation trade. Very good
recommendation very, very trade good book. I actually haven't read that many classics, to be honest with you.
They're not writer. Worth it. They're like on a broad spectrum, they're really not worth it.
I just think personally that a lot of the classics, it doesn't matter what you're reading so long as you enjoy it. So, and none of those books I haven't really come across many of them in my time writing because I'm very much self-taught. So I don't think they're any more or less important than any other book that's been written, you know?
Oh, no, absolutely. Oh, man. But, you know, you could never say that in a lecture hall.
Oh, I would. You underestimate me.
Oh, no, it's like... So one class we were covering Heart of Darkness, and I think I just straight up raised my hand and I was like, so do I have to like this book? The prof was like, well, no, you don't have to like this book. I'm like, good, because I hate it. I hate this book. In the middle of the lecture hall, it was a bit, I feel like it was a waste of time, but it was good for me. I felt good about doing that. So yeah, a lot of power. But yeah, the classics. I don't know. Literally the only one that I can recommend is Mrs. Dalloway because it's the book. It's one of the classics that meets a specific criteria for me in that it's less about its context. It's less about the author. It's less about all that hooey and just about the way Virginia Woolf makes the novel, right? It's here's a person trying their best to make the novel in the most interesting way that they can, right? Trying to bend the rules and basically make a novel almost without making one. So for that, I can recommend it. But yeah, so many of the classics have a lot of respect that I cannot get behind, like a lot of them, you know, I wouldn't say that there's like no point in studying them. Because there's like half a point, but it's like getting harder and harder to justify reading these books, you know, for a lot of reasons. It's getting so much harder to justify like doing these things because not only are, you know, they're old, ancient, boring, and the language is getting more and more archaic as the days go by, but not only that, there are other authors who have done exactly what these people have done, but better. That we don't study or don't acknowledge in a sense. We need to pay homage to the classics for some weird reason that I don't understand, at least in my degree. I think that's been one of my big challenges is trying to understand the place of the classics and what the hell do we do with the canon? You know, why do we have this immense headcanon of books that are just beyond that we don't need them anymore. Why are we still reading them? Like I don't know that there are other works, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There have to be other books. That's like the thought in my head. I'm like, as I grace Heart of Darkness for like the third year in a row, I'm like, there have to be other books.
I think your real pet peeve is that you have to keep reading these things over and over.
Seriously, like Was there no other books? Was there like, I can't believe you won't sell me that there was like a shortage of books to pick, you know?
Anyway. Do you think that being an English major has impacted, like, along with this, do you think that reading these books and being an English major and having to do all these things that are kind of out of your control in a way have impacted how you write?
Well, you know, I wouldn't say so. I would say that reading these books has allowed me to, and a lot of these books I don't finish, you know, to my shock and horror. I don't care for the plot of these books. And usually by the midway point of a book, an author has given up all their secrets, right? They've shown you how they build structure, how they build character, how they build these elements, right? Whether or not they pay off isn't really, like, I think the payoff, that is almost up to interpretation. You can pay off all of these things you set up however you want.
Your English teachers must love reading your papers.
I don't know. I mean, my grades don't, but I don't know. Talking with me, I'm certain, is a different experience. You know, and so by the halfway point of a book, in my opinion, I've gleaned about all I need to. I only read and finished Mrs. Dalloway because there was a term paper, and I did so badly that my prof was like, "You need to do this again, but better, because you completely misinterpreted the instructions." And I was like, "Oh, okay." So I had to read Mrs. Dalloway like fully, but the point is, when you get to that point in a book, you've picked up the things that they're going to do. And with mm-hmm. that, bring it into your own writing, which I find that I would like to do or try to do. So there are good techniques that they employ. That's another thing, that there are good and strong attributes of the classics that you can glean, but you can also critically evaluate them and go, "This stinks. This is terrible. I don't need this part. I don't know why they used this." And basically create your own version, right? When you read a classic, you got to think, how could this book be so much better? And then you take all of that information, and when you write your book, you're like, hey, I'm going to include these cool elements of this book that I thought were really awesome, but I'm also going to leave out all this dumb stuff that they literally didn't need. For example, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea includes countless, countless lines about the Nautilus, this proclaimed submarine from a time in which there were no such thing as submarines. So I don't remember his name, honestly, glad for it. The author spent a lot of time, Jules Verne, a lot of time describing the technology in the Nautilus, describing how it all worked, describing this, describing that. And that's cool, but I don't think anyone cares anymore. Because now, I don't want to shock you, we actually have submarines. So you don't need to describe to us what a submarine does. And the more time that goes on that we understand submarines, the less effect those words have. And that sucks, because a book should have an immortality to it. You know, it should live on. But I don't want to read 70 pages on how this thing works. It's not relevant to me anymore. But, you know, the book is kind of cool. It's got all this underwater stuff and there's a squid or whatever. Conversely, there's Brave New World by Huxley. That's an interesting book. Got some interesting ideas floating around. Cool. One thing I really liked about it, an element that I would take and I would probably reuse or repurpose, a lot of times in these like society pieces about, you know, societal change or adaptation, like 1984, Brave New World, or things like that nature, they kind of like tease elements of the world and how it's all structured, right? They don't want to let you know all the ramifications about these things. Brave New World turns that completely on its head before people start doing that. The book begins, and it's not a spoiler because it's the first 20 pages. The book begins with a man leading a group of students into this foundry, this factory area, where human beings are grown and conditioned from conception to like the age of 9.
Ooh.
And you see the entire process. You don't even meet the main character until that group of students bumps into him. And that I thought was excellent. I'm like, this is so cool. You know, like you're showing, you're, instead of making us think and like theorize about how it all works. You're just showing us the show, pulling the curtain back and saying, this is our world. These are the things I'm thinking about. This is the future I imagine, which I thought was so cool. When 1984 does this, a similar thing, talking about different ideas, but using a similar kind of technique, there is this, you know, outsider looking in, right? We see Winston as the, I think that's his name, who cares? You know, we see the character grumble under the minute processes of this regime, of this situation, of this society. We don't really know what it's like to be an authority figure in this society. And that, I think, is a really, really cool contrast. However, those books end up getting so boring and dumb, and have so many issues with them that I can't even, I would take up 3 hours talking about. So I didn't finish Brave New World, and God willing, I skimmed about 80% of 1984 because the text is meh.
Boring.
That's another thing. Why write a boring book? Why is your book so boring? You could do all this stuff and make it not boring, and other writers have done so. Like Fahrenheit 451, I think. That's another crazy one, like about society and stuff. Whoa, society. And it's apparently not boring. The Hunger Games, honestly, it's YA, but it does a really good job. It shows a dystopian society, class difference. Whoa, it's kind of crazy, but it's...
So I have an opinion about The Hunger Games, and I wonder if you share this too.
Please.
I personally didn't like The Hunger Games that much because it felt very hypocritical, because in the story, in the actual arena or the death match, the actual Hunger Games, the book kind of commentates on how everything is a spectacle, how people are focusing on the romance rather than the gore. But when I read the books and when I watch the movies, it feels like even the movies themselves are forgetting that lesson and focusing directly on the romance and the action rather than the horrors of the game.
Yeah. I think that's an absolutely valid point. The books seem to... I personally loved the books because the interiority of a book allowed me to bond with Katniss way more than the movies. Not that, not that she didn't do a good job. She did a great job, but I just, you know, there was more to chew on for Katniss's character, right? That,
yeah.
You know, and for other reasons too, but I just think like the element of their setting, right? And I, you know, it's not perfect. I don't think it is. And I didn't love it as, you know, anybody. I wasn't a diehard. Insofar as dystopian novel, like from subject to execution of that, I think it did a fine job. You know, it's obviously, you know, a lot of people know that it's very, very heavily influenced by from the Battle Royale series. So there's that. It's very, very clear about that. But insofar as it's world building, I think it is excellent. And I do agree. I mean, the movies, I think it's like in the later movies, there's this scene in which a bunch of like rebels or just peasants or something, like just ordinary citizens, they rush at this building and this garrison or this turret just like lights them all up. And I'm like, oh my God, like that's brutal. And I think it was something to do with like a natural resource. Like they were going charging a water plant or something, or just charging as revolution. And it was pretty gripping. It was pretty gripping. It was kind of weird to me that like pretty much up until the end, the book or series took so much precedence over these games. The Hunger Games, oh man, my brain is working. I hate this. because it exemplifies the sense of powerlessness that everybody else feels. Katniss literally volunteered to save her sister. She's stuck in these macabre games that she can't get away from. She also gets lumped into the press. So she's not only a public figure, she's somebody who has to fight for her life, and whilst doing so, can't actually interact with the rebellion that she would like to be a part of. She's a tool of the state, yet at the same time is trying to undermine it. And while she competes in the games, we're thinking, Christ, what's happening all over the world? Like, what's happening all over the districts, right? That's where the real story is. Like, that's where the great conflict occurs. But we're stuck in our powerlessness with Katniss because we have to play in these games and play the romance role and satisfy the public desire for my performance, which kind of brings us back to the idea of a writer and their work. Because a writer, by definition, is caught in this public trap of, well, I have to do these things. I have to be the writer. I have to write these things because I want to. But the perception of public image upon myself is comforting because they want Katniss to be this warrior, stoic beauty who loves Peeta Mellark and has this heartbreaking tale. You know, they want Katniss to be X or Y. They desire her in these social roles. We desire artists and writers to fit their social roles as well. We want, even though they're horrible and I hate them, we want the beanie. we want the guys who kick their feet up and go, society, man. And we go, oh my God, that's so deep. And that's what we want. We want writers to fill these roles, just like we want Katniss, or they wanted Katniss to be the hero they wanted. Wow.
Wow. I feel like you would make an excellent book critic. Like, you would make a book based off of the book, just on your thoughts.
Oh, boy. Suggest it to me, because I'll do it.
I won't suggest it, because then your poor partner will be like, hey, what have you been doing all day? And you'll be like, well, and he'll be like, no, go away. Go away.
Oh, man.
But so we did end up talking a lot, and we are almost at the end point, so I have two more questions for you.
Okay, lightning round. No tangents.
Okay. Oh, you're going to go. I don't know if you can do lightning.
Let's go.
Okay. All right. So, last two questions. Is there anything we haven't talked about yet that you would like to talk about?
No, I don't think so. I think this has been a wonderful interview to which we have discussed many, many conversationable things. Though if there's one more question you have to ask, then we haven't broached that yet. Please continue, Eli.
Okay, thank you. We have one more. I just wanted to ask, is there anything you'd like to say to any creators out there, anyone who's just starting to get into things but doesn't know exactly what they want to do or what they're doing?
Okay. I'm going to be very deliberate about this.
Okay.
You do not need to read stories, reading books, to learn how to write, to learn how to create. There is no authority on how to build skills in the arts. You said yourself you were self-taught. I myself am self-taught. School has, I think, helped, push me a little, but I myself have majorly been self-taught. And the last thing is, you need to love the thing you make before anybody else does. You need to love it. Because if you don't love a thing you make, it's not going to be very good. You can still make good things that you dislike. And you can make a thing you like that you will inevitably dislike. But if you want something to be amazing, or you want it to make something amazing, you have to love it. That's it. You gotta love it, you gotta put everything you love into it, and you have to show it to people. That's it.
That's the hardest part.
That's the hardest part, but that's just how it's done. That's the entire process.
I like that advice. I think that's very good advice. I would agree with that.
And that's it. No drama, no prep, just do you love it? Okay, so make it. Make that thing then. If you love it so much.
Yeah. And to add on to that, people are always saying that you need to, I guess, find your audience. And well, yeah, you should find your niche if you can. But know that no matter what you make, there will always be someone out there who will be like, yes, this is exactly what I need. So even if your niche you can't find it immediately. You'll find it eventually. You'll find the people who love it as well.
I agree.
All right. Well, if you have nothing else to say, I think we're good. So this has been another episode of In the Margins. If you like our show, check us out at RadioLaurier.com or at our Instagram page at In the Margins Podcast for more episodes. And if you want to check out John's Instagram, you can find him at John Arthur Wood. So John, thank you very, very much for coming to chat with me. It was a lot of fun. We got a lot of good chats. And I think if you wanted to, you could absolutely come on again, because we have a lot of things I think we could still talk about.
If you're completely okay with my rambly mess of conversation, I would love to come on your show another time. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Thank you for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.